You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 248 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman The Adventures Continue, Season 2, Number 2, Justice League Infinity, Number 1, The Swamp Thing, Number 5, Crime Syndicate, Number 5, Batman, 110, Green Lantern, Number 4, Justice League, Number 64, Wonder Girl, Number 2, The Flash, Season 7, Episode 16, POW, and Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 1, Out of the Deep Woods. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC News. We got an update on Tom King and Greg Smallwood's new Black Label DC title, Human Target. And it's supposed to debut November 2nd, kicking off a 12-issue run.
I'm excited. They showed that the Justice League International appears to be part of the plot. Not like in a minor appearance, but part of the plot. So that's cool. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited about that, too. I've always liked that iteration of the Justice League. You know, it's different from the regular lineup, and it was a fun read back in the day, so I'm looking forward to that as well. Up next for DC News, we got Superman and the Authority Number 1 going on sale July 20th as planned, but the other three issues of the four-issue series have been delayed. And the series was originally planned to run twice monthly, but the new schedule slows it down to monthly, with the exception of the final issue. Now, DC has informed retailers that they have chosen to delay these issues in light of retailer feedback. And they're also making the second issue returnable for retailers. So, I found that interesting. It was because of retailer feedback that DC changed their plan. Kind of sounds like they're kind of slowing it down to let the retailers decide how many issues they want to order, is what I'm gathered from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't know how the issues or, you know, how the series is going to do. And if it's coming out as quickly as they had originally intended, it kind of forces your hand to order early, right? And I mean, if the series is a hit, that's great, that's fine. But if it's not, you know, then you end up with all these extra issues that you can't sell. Or, I mean, in the other case, it's a hit, but you know, you play it safe and you don't order too much, then you're missing out on sales you could have had. So, yeah, it makes sense to me completely.
So, yeah, I just thought that was interesting. All right, up next for DC News, Paper Girls artist Cliff Chiang returns to DC for Catwoman Lonely City, a 48-page Black Label 4-issue miniseries that'll debut on October 19th. 10 years ago, the massacre known as Fool's Night claimed the lives of Batman, Joker, Nightwing, and Commissioner Gordon, and sent Selina Kyle to prison. A decade later, Gotham has grown up. It's put away costume heroism and villainy, childish things. The new Gotham is cleaner, safer, and a lot less free. Under the watchful eye of Mayor Harvey Dent and his Bat Cops, it's into this new city that Selina Kyle returns, a changed woman. With her mind on that one last big score, the secrets hidden inside the Batcave. She doesn't need the money, she just needs to know who is Orpheus. When I read that description, I was like, wow, this sounds really different, and it really intrigued me. I'm kind of curious about it. It's a 4-issue series, but it's 48 pages. So, I don't know, it sounds pretty cool to me.
I totally agree. I'm very intrigued by the premise. We know for sure we're going to get great art. Paper Girls is one of the big creator-owned things that he's done recently over at Image. But he also did the New 52 Wonder Woman run with Brian Azzarello. And I mean, I know not everybody was crazy. It was a pretty successful run. I mean, not everybody liked the decisions that Azzarello made, but the art was consistently great. So I'm very intrigued by the story, but I know at worst it's going to at least look good.
I don't know. It sounds pretty cool to me, so I'm excited about it. All right, up next for DC News, DC announces a new series for Nubia, Queen of the Amazons. They'll be written by Vita Ayala and Stephanie Williams, with art by Aletha Martinez and Mark Morales. Nubia and the Amazons number one goes on sale October 5th, and DC hasn't specified the length of the series yet.
You have to imagine that's a mini series, right? I can't. If it's not, I mean, they're not setting it up for success. I just cannot see her sustaining an ongoing. I'm not saying that she doesn't deserve a series, but I would assume they're going to go the mini series route.
I agree with you. I'm sure it's going to be a mini series, and I knew they're going to put something out with Nubia. I mean, they had her in Future State, but I making her Queen of the Amazons, I knew they were going to do something with her. They just weren't just going to stop there and leave that as the status quo.
She's like queen of a specific. One thing I'm hoping that they do is I feel like it's a little bit confusing what the exact status of all the Amazons are, because she's definitely a queen, but I don't think she's the Thymaskiran queen, because I'm pretty sure that's still Hippolyta. And we'll get into that when we talk about the Wonder Girl issue, but I feel like it's a little bit. I feel like DC's a little bit hazy on what exactly what's going on with Wonder Woman.
I have to agree with you on that. Well, we'll discuss that more later. Up next for DC News, Young Justice Season 4 will be premiering October 21st, titled Young Justice Phantoms.
That's cool. I really like the show. I think you started to watch it with your kids, right, Drew?
I did, and then we got away from it, but I've seen that Season 4 is coming out. It kind of piqued my interest in picking it back up and watching it some more, so.
I wonder if it will. I know it's already, I think, moved over to HBO Max, but I wonder if a new season coming out might give that show some new life. Obviously, it has a pretty dedicated fan base, but it's not, I think, as big as it could be, because it is very good. And I wonder if reaching, clearly HBO Max is going to reach a wider audience than the DC app did. And, it had been gone for quite a while from Cartoon Network before it got resurrected that way. So we'll see. It could be really good. I mean, I'm excited just for more of the show, but it could also just be good for the growth of the fandom of the show too.
I agree. Coming up last for DC News, FX on Hulu released a new teaser trailer for the upcoming adaptation of Why the Last Man, coming September 13th. Now, I saw the teaser trailer. It wasn't much. It basically was just went over the premise of what the show is, that all the men disappeared and York was the last one left. So that's pretty much all it kind of teased, but didn't really show any footage. It's all animated kind of stuff. So I'm still curious what the show is actually going to look like.
I have high hopes for it. I mean, obviously we know the series is very critically acclaimed. I have high hopes because FX, the one that I can think of, I don't know if they produced other adaptations, but they did Legion, and that, I don't know if you ever watched that, Drew. It was an X-Men property, technically. It's phenomenal. It's one of the best superhero shows I've seen. At least the first season was so good. So I have high hopes for Why the Last Man.
No, I have not seen Legion, so, but I'm excited. I've read the Why the Last Man series, so I'm excited about seeing it on the live action version of it. So, very curious to see what it's going to look like. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Of the myriad pop culture podcasts, there is one that blends in with them all, flying under the radar, nagging at you at a subconscious level. Nerd Bliss, where four hosts from the Deep South and anyone they can get to appear for store brand coffee and corn nuts talk about science fiction, pop culture, current affairs, and more. You can find us at nerdblisspodcast.com or on the ESO network. Nerd Bliss. It's one word.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers. 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 We got spoilers. Spoilers. For you. We got spoilers. 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 We've got spoilers. Spoilers. For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman. The Adventures Continue, Season 2, Number 2. This issue starts off in the Batcave. Batman tells Deadman if the Talons are really the undead, he'd like to know what makes them tick. And since he doesn't have anything better to do, Deadman jumps inside of Alfred and has a conversation with Nightwing. Alfred reminds Batman that Bruce Wayne needs to make an appearance at Mayor Hill's funeral, and Deadman decides to tag along. Three figures in the distance are watching the funeral, and Bruce suggests Boston go check it out. Deadman follows them into a church where he is ambushed by zombies, and the zombies are dissipating Deadman. Batman shows up and saves Deadman, and Batman is able to collect a Talon's finger. Mrs. Hill and her son have a discussion about the transfer of money by Mayor Hill behind his wife's back. Mrs. Hill demands that Junior reverse the funds back into their original accounts by the time the bank closes tomorrow. Batman learns from running tests on the Talon's finger that the zombies are susceptible to cold. Junior learns that his father is not dead and is part of the Court of Owls. Mayor Hill tells Junior to turn over the money. The court needs it to rebuild. Junior can either gain authority and immortality at his father's side or die. Batman and Deadman show up at the old City Hall building, the HQ for the Court of Owls. Batman tells Hill to surrender, but Hill detonates explosives for demolition, and Batman is able to save Junior. The issue ends with Batman and Deadman going their separate ways.
Now, I'm assuming some of the plot points in here are going to come back at some point during this season two arc, but this was not particularly satisfying conclusion, if I'm being honest with you, Drew. I mean, it's certainly not poorly written by any means, but like it wrapped up so cleanly. And again, I'm sure that it isn't fully over, but it was too fast for me.
I agree with you. I thought it ended abruptly also. It just kind of, you know, Batman saves Junior, then all of a sudden Batman and Deadman are going their separate ways, like, we're done with this case. I'm like, are we?
Well, and then the sort of the reveal that and this is where I'm wondering if it's going to be like this guy wasn't really the actual Court of Owls or something like. And this is just speculation on my part, because ultimately the Court of Owls was really just the mayor. There was no court. It was just him. And it seemed to, from his side of the story, it seemed to be something that he was like reviving, that the court had like disappeared or like become defunct and he was resuscitating it. And so my guess is maybe we're going to learn that he was essentially a rogue agent or, you know, was misguided and the actual Court of Owls is still kind of hidden in the shadows. I don't know. That might just be wishful thinking, but it was very underwhelming.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with that. Because, like you said, the Court of Owls should be more than just one man. And it did kind of feel like he was trying to resurrect something, but it also felt like, with all those Talons, it also felt like They were still in existence. So I guess we'll have to see what happens in future stories.
Yeah. I don't want to judge it too harshly because I don't know what their plan is for the whole season two. I have to assume that they're not done fully with the court, just because if they are, it's a bummer, because they could have done a lot more. It just, to me, if this is the end of their version of the Court of Owls, and I'm not sure that it is, but if it was, I would question the point of even doing it, because it's such a cheap, really shallow adaptation of the Court of Owls. I get them doing their spin, like we saw them do their spin on, you know, Deathstroke and Red Hood in season one. And I get trying to do their spin on another modern Batman story, but setting it in the animated universe. So I get the desire to do that. But if this is all they're going to do, then I would have rather them just done something else.
I don't think they're done with it. I think it felt like, to me, it was unfinished, something we'd revisit.
I hope so. And I, like I said, I do think that's going to be the case, because, I mean, we saw ultimately there was a big overreaching story in season one. And I assume that that's going to be the court for season two. So I suspect it'll come back. I mean, the mayor's son, the mayor in waiting, it seems also, I mean, like that seems rather unresolved also.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League Infinity Number 1. Martian Manhunter left the Justice League to travel the world seeking a better understanding of human beings by shape-shifting into nationalities, races, and genders. He's found out what he was truly seeking, and that was a better understanding of himself. Wally West gets a surprise birthday party thrown by the Justice League. But the birthday party is interrupted when a boom tube appears, and it's Granny Goodness. She tells her parademons not to let any Justice Leaguer leave this room alive. Another boom tube announces the arrival of Kalibak, son of Darkseid. Since Darkseid has abandoned Apocalypse, there has been chaos and confusion as the warring factions seek dominance over that world. Both Granny Goodness and Kalibak think they can destroy the Justice League and win the favor of the people of Apocalypse. Mr. Miracle uses his mother box to create two boom tubes that suck all the villains away. Flash says it's the best present ever, but Batman tells Flash he needs to clean up the mess, which he does in 7 seconds, we find out. Not only is Martian Manhunter trying to find himself, so is Amazo. During Amazo's ranting, he breaks a mirror and releases some sort of energy that ends up possessing Superman at the end of the issue during his and Lois's dinner date. It was cool that we're getting a Justice League comic based off the animated series. But with the Martian Manhunter part of the story and the other part of the story, it felt kind of split to me on what the story was trying to tell us.
I found it hard to follow, not because it was hard to understand, but the Martian Manhunter thought boxes were so disconnected from the action that we were seeing in the artwork. It was I had a really hard time reading that and then trying to read, so to speak, the action in the art. I thought that they could have, I don't know how you do it differently. If you tie what he's saying more directly, I know he's commenting loosely on what's happening, but he's also just kind of lost in his own, thoughts and philosophy and all of that. And I get that, but I found it distracting at times. I had a hard time kind of bouncing between the two.
You're not the only one. I thought they should have just cut out the Martian Manhunter stuff altogether. I didn't think we needed it for this story. I know it sounds like he's on the outs with the Justice League, or he wants to be out on his own. But we know he's eventually going to come back. I could just tell by reading his stuff.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that I also felt a little frustration with that, because I was like, why are we dancing around the bush here? Obviously, he's going to come back. If he wasn't going to come back, he wouldn't be in the story. I could be wrong, but I can't imagine you writing a 6, 12 issues, whatever, story, and Martian Manhunter sits on the sideline the entire time moping. I mean, what? Clearly, he's going to come into play into the plot at some point. So why are we acting like you're not going to do that? That Yeah, I was a little annoyed by that.
Okay, there was one thing I wanted to ask you, and that was what was up with Batman and Wonder Woman? Because I was very curious, are they dating? Because we got this dialogue here. Batman's like, "I hate birthdays." Wonder Woman goes, "You'll have to forgive him, Wally. He has a difficult time expressing his feelings, don't you, Bruce?" And Batman goes, "You would know."
Well, if you remember, they had a pretty strongly hinted at romantic relationship towards, especially like as the show continued. That was, it makes sense. Like if you're continuing the animated Justice League story, it makes sense for those two of to have continued to grow closer.
Yeah, they always hinted at it, but they never came out and said it. And
Right.
I've.
And that this felt in kind of the same spirit as that, whereas it's hinted at strongly, but we're not explicitly seeing it, at least not yet.
Yeah, and that always kind of intrigued me what a relationship between the two would look like. And, they never explored it the way I wanted it explored, so. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. The Swamp Thing number 5. In New York, Levi packs his bag and leaves Jennifer Reese's apartment because he is unable to tell her the thing that pulled her from the swamp, the monster that plagues her dreams. It's him. Levi contemplates disappearing from her life, but before he can reach his own apartment, the Green calls for him again. Sierra Kiera calls on John Constantine because her friend Nigel went out 2 days ago to get smokes and hasn't returned. Sierra is unable to leave her apartment because of the fascist. John and Sierra go in search of Nigel and find Swamp Thing. Sierra sees Nigel is trapped with pipes growing out of him, and John theorizes that there is a Nazi World War II bomb underneath him. Swamp Thing explains that the bomb is using Nigel in a slow explosion, altering the reality of this place. It's turning people into fascists. Those caught in the blast are susceptible. John Constantine arrives in the dream of a crumbling old London. He searches for a lost boy tangled in memories of a bomb. He finds Nigel and pulls him out from the ghost of a war long past. Then John and Syria disappear into the night. Swamp Thing goes into the ground and retrieves the bomb and takes it to the desolate edge of a distant island. As the last remnants of a radioactive idea dissipate, so does Swamp Thing. Then in India, we see that Amanda Waller has an idea to capture the Swamp Thing.
What a good issue, Drew. This whole series has been phenomenal. Not shocking, given that this guy is also killing it on Justice League Dark right now, but man, this might have been my favorite one yet.
It was pretty good, and it was very strange because it was like they were actually doing the things, but it was kind of mythological also. It was kind of a cool story. The Amanda Waller thing at the end, I know they're trying to set up what's going to be happening next. I didn't think it belonged in this issue.
That felt a little frustrating. I'm hoping it's something that the writer actually wants to do, and it's not being mandated by the editorial team, because that's what it kind of felt a little bit like. DC's clearly pushing a big Suicide Squad Waller thing right now, which makes sense. There's the movie that's coming out, and so naturally Peacekeeper's been prominently involved too. I get it. I don't begrudge them for doing it, but in this case, it felt like it didn't belong in this series.
I agree with you, and we announced it in DC News that they were doing a crossover into the two titles. So the story is crossing over with Suicide Squad. We know that already. So obviously it's happening next issue. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Crime Syndicate number 5. The Legion of Justice tracks Johnny Quick to the farm he grew up on. Power Tower and Savannah are coming through the barn when they come across a bunch of dead bodies. Power Tower freaks out and breaks through the barn's roof. Then Atomica shoots through Power Tower like a bullet. Emerald Knight kills Johnny Quick. The next morning, Owlman, Ultraman, and Superwoman go to Johnny Quick's farm to investigate. They discover Johnny's killing spree began with his brothers, and they also come across Atomica. Now, while the Legion of Justice discusses the failed mission, Owlman's Owlbots invade the satellite computer systems and shuts down their defenses. Then the crime syndicate attacks. When Ultraman is about to kill Luther, he's stopped by his cousin Kara.
This was fine. I've enjoyed the back half of this story more than the Starro one, personally, just because, I mean, it's, I think, at least attempting to do something new. I don't know. I can't get over my disappointment in the series, Drew. I was hoping for more than what it's been.
I know, and I think I've liked it a lot better than you have. When I read this issue, I kind of thought back to the Starro thing, and it made me realize what they're doing in this miniseries is introducing what I guess they're calling, what I'm calling, the new version of the crime syndicate. And it made me realize they did the Starro story to mirror the Justice League story with the origin of the crime syndicate.
Right. Yeah.
And we're, now that we've gotten past that story, we're getting into newer takes on the characters.
I guess my main argument, I mean, I agree. I mean, that's clear what they were trying to do. I just question whether that's necessary, especially in the era that we're in of, you know, all continuity matters. All these stories have actually happened. So it's, in other words, in on some level, that means you're trusting readers to actually remember that these stories happened before and that you're not telling the same story, but assuming the readers never read the story before. So like if this was New 52 era, I think this story would make more sense because you're like reintroducing the crime syndicate. But we're in this era of all the DC stuff has happened. We already know who the crime syndicate is, Drew. I don't need to be reintroduced to them. I don't want an origin story. I know maybe not everybody is super familiar with the crime syndicate, but I'm going to be honest with you. Most people reading this book probably are. I have a hard time believing that if you did like a pie chart of people buying this title, of people who don't know who the crime syndicate are compared to those who do, is going to be majority people don't know who they are. So if you know your target audience, do I really need a crime syndicate begins? Not really. I think I'd rather just see a new crime syndicate story.
I agree with you, but we are in an era of a reboot. Infinite Frontier is definitely a reboot. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're doing the introduction to the crime syndicate, basically.
I mean, and to be fair, they are trying to do stuff that's new because, like, Johnny Quick, at least for now, appears to be dead. That's different. You know, they're doing a version of John Stewart instead of Hal Jordan for Green Lantern. Like, you can see they're changing stuff. Atomica is a new, I mean, she was not obviously an original crime syndicate member. That's, I think, New 52 introduction. So like there is stuff that's new relatively to the team, but it's still mainly just like stuff we've seen before. My hope coming into this was that it was just going to hit the ground running, that we had just assumed the crime syndicate was a thing. We know who the members are. And yes, you can change some of them hard, but I don't need an introduction to them. Just be like, yeah, Atomic is on the team now. Okay. You know what I mean? And just tell a crime syndicate story. And you could argue that that's what they're doing, but I think I would have rather seen them just like being the crime syndicate instead of becoming the crime syndicate.
Yeah, and I think that's where your main disappointment lies, is you don't want to see the origin story. You just want to see a story moving forward, doing something new.
It's just not that – it's not that interesting to me, and because we know they become the – it's one of those things – it's why I'm glad that superhero movies, for example, have done – for the most part, obviously we still get them, but they've changed the formula. We don't get a ton of origin stories anymore. Because it's like you're watching Spider-Man. Like, I know he's going to become Spider-Man. I don't need to sit in suspense for 2 hours. Will he? Won't he? You know what I mean? Like, so it's just that's the frustration. I know that they're going to become the team. I know what the dynamic of the team is going to be. Ultimately, we know where it's going. So why do we have to do this song and dance to get to there?
Understand. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman number 110. A few moments ago, a blast destroyed part of City Hall. Mayor Nakano allows the magistrate to investigate, and Police Commissioner Montoya is not happy about the decision. Oracle puts the Bat family on high alert. Batman is out of communication, and Nightwing heads towards Gotham. Batman is fighting Peacekeeper 1, Sean Mahoney, and Batman tells Sean that Simon Saint is behind the bombing of City Hall. Sean tells Batman he's the one that planted the bomb to further Simon Saint's vision. Sean made sure there was nobody around to get hurt. Oracle calls in Ghostmaker to extract Batman. We see Batman sets off explosions in Morse code to Ghostmaker, who puts the ghost stream into position just as Batman is jumping from the building. Batman and Ghostmaker do some acrobatics and then land on a rooftop. Harley Quinn tells Batman and Ghostmaker that Sean Mahoney was a corrupt guard at Arkham that roughed up the inmates. Batman states that Scarecrow is working with Simon Saint and Mahoney, but it's not clear what Scarecrow gains from all this. Now the magistrate shows up at the Insanity Collective's HQ. Miracle Molly surrenders with no resistance. Peacekeeper 1 calls Simon Saint and tells him that the Insanity Collective is armed and resisting, so Simon Saint grants the request to use lethal force.
I'm sure you feel the same way, Drew. I am just quite done with the framing device of whatever is going on in what we assume is the future between Batman and Scarecrow. Like, get to it already. Like, what is that story? We get so little of it, and it's so detached from what the main story of each of these comics has been. Like, you can forget. By the time you reach the end of the comic, I typically have forgotten that there was that little intro bit. But it happens every issue.
Yes, and it's quite annoying. Because you know what's going to happen. Batman's going to get captured at some point. Scarecrow is going to try to alter his brain or thinking or whatever he's trying to, mind controlling him, whatever he's trying to do. And Batman's going to get out of it. We know what's going to happen. I'm tired of that at the beginning of every issue, too. I just want it to be over with now. I am excited that Nightwing's headed to Gotham and joining the story. I like to see more of the Bat family. I'm not that big on Ghostmaker. He's basically Batman 2.0.
One thing that I am interested in, and I like what Tinian is doing, is showing how overmatched the mayor is for the job. He is just deeply unqualified and has completely lost control of the city, but he doesn't want to admit it. And that's not, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I like how Tinian is showing that, because it makes more sense how a guy like Simon Saint can come in and kind of fill the power vacuum and take over. That being said, it's still frustrating because it feels like it's leading towards, you know, the magistrate that we saw in Future State, but in a way it still doesn't make sense that the Bat family couldn't stop this. You know what I mean? I'm sure it won't play out exactly the same as we saw in Future State, but it seems like it's continuing to progress towards that point, not because it necessarily makes sense for the story, but because they've already dictated that's where the story goes. So even though there should be ways to stop it ahead of time, well, we've already said it's going there, so it's going to go there.
Now, we did not see Ghostmaker in Future State. So I'm wondering what Ghostmaker is going to add to the story that's going to change it.
I'm almost wondering if that's the whole thing. It's Ghostmaker's presence is going to somehow be the thing that tips the scales.
Because that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much I care about that, but sure. Tinian clearly wants to make Ghostmaker a thing. So, I mean, just as badly, if not more badly, than he wants to make Punchline a thing. So, you know, go for it, dude.
Yeah, I have a feeling once he's off the title, so will Ghostmaker.
I don't know. I could see that one being pushed. That and they just dedicated so much to him and Punchline. Certainly more so company resource wise on Punchline, but I don't know. I mean, the dude's like a white ninja Batman. I can see somebody else wanting to do something with that.
I just hope they don't do like they did in Nightfall and have him take over as Batman. I could see them trying to do that too.
The only reason I think they wouldn't do that, Drew, is because they already have his actual replacement, right?
That's true. But it does feel like when they brought Azrael in and had him take over the mantle.
It does. And that's the thing. I think that's the thing that's most interesting to me is because if we didn't, and this is, again, the thing that annoys me with Future State, if we didn't know about Future State, it would look a lot like it's supposed to be Ghostmaker taking over as Batman at some point, inevitably. I mean, maybe that happens, but what clearly seems to be the case is that it's Jace Fox, which is I'm fine with that, but I'd like to not necessarily know that already.
Yeah, I agree with you. That it'd be more of a surprise if we didn't know that already. They could have done a whole story about him taking over too.
You can argue that there's more. You could make the argument that there's more tension because we know where this story could go because of Future State. But to me, I feel like it's undercut a lot of the attention because we know exactly what Simon Saint's plan is. We know exactly what the magistrates can do. So, you know, I don't know. To me, it's taken a lot of the tension away, not added the threat.
All right. We also had a backup Ghostmaker story, and this is chapter 4 of it. Ghostmaker is under Madame Midas's compound. The wannabe Killer Croc assassin tells his story of how he was defeated by Ghostmaker. And Madame Midas orders all the access tunnels to be collapsed. Why is every story of this about the assassins telling their story of how Ghostmaker defeated them? Doesn't seem like something... As an assassin, I would want to be telling my employer about my failures.
I found the entire plot structure of this whole thing to be incredibly stupid. Like I think the other problem is it's so similar. Every issue, it's the same. We know exactly what it's going to be. It's another one of them telling about the time that Ghostmaker kicked their ass. Okay. That there's not enough there to engage me for that trope to be interesting. Like, they're just a story about a bit like weirdly set in the past for some reason.
Yeah, it's strange. And it just furthers how awesome Ghostmaker is, how they're trying to overdo Ghostmaker. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Lantern number 4. John Stewart is being hunted by the Quinori, and he learns that there is a bounty on the 1001 Green Lanterns that were sent to Dark Sector 1. The number of closed bounties are 300. John is able to trick the Quinori and steal a gun and equipment, and John gets to the Quinori ship and easily takes it over with most of the Quinori already on the planet. John disables their weapons and lets the locals deal out the Quinori punishment. On Oa, Joe is going over a list of Lantern's whereabouts. Jinko Sin, confirmed dead. Guy Gardner, missing. Ariza Arab, confirmed dead. And I was surprised about that one. I like Ariza. Iolanade, located. Ismot Cole, confirmed dead. I remember him from John's run. Wasn't he the alligator Green Lantern, if I remember right?
I can't remember.
Anyways, I think that's who that is. Kyle Rayner, he's missing. And then Rot Lop Fan was located. I didn't even remember that lantern. Simon Baz is working on hunting down prisoners freed from the science cells. The good news is the big bads are locked up because their cells have mech locks. Joe meets with Counselor Fell of the United Planets. And the condition of the Guardians is unchanged. There is a 90% chance the Guardians are dying and a 76% chance that they're already dead. Joe and Counselor Fell discuss the fact that the central battery was not blown up, but disassembled on a quantum level. Everything powered by the battery stayed connected to it, and that includes the Guardians. The top five suspects behind this attack are the Red Lanterns, the Bright Circle, the Reach, the Controllers, and of course, Sinestro. And we see that Teen Lantern gets upset that people have been hurt and takes off for New Korriger to do something about it. And me personally, Cletus, I don't think Sinestro is behind this. To me, it doesn't feel like something Sinestro would do. I mean, it's possible, but I don't think so. I think Teen Lantern's, I think she just jumped to conclusions, gonna go there, and it's not gonna be Sinestro behind it, and she's just gonna cause trouble with Sinestro.
Yeah, her going after Sinestro didn't totally make sense either. It felt like there was almost something else going on there. Like, it wasn't really about Sinestro, which I'm sure is going to be the case. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting more context for that, because I was a little bit – they threw in that line, like, wasn't she, like, dealing with PTSD or something? I was like, wait, what? You can't – that's not enough of an explanation.
No, it's not.
Sort of, you know what I mean? I felt like a sort of hand-wavy, like, we're going to have this character irrationally run off for no reason. And she's dealing with PTSD. What? That's not enough? PTSD of what specifically? Being attacked by a yellow lantern? Because if that's not the case, then that doesn't really make sense. Her dad looks like Sinestro? I don't know. I need more.
Her dad looks like Sinestro.
I just, you know what I mean? Like, you can't just say, you just can't hand wave and be like, yeah, whatever, PTSD, that explains it. No, it doesn't. That's not enough, comic.
You know Joe's going to go after her. And I would be surprised.
I agree, but I'm hoping and I'm assuming we're going to get more context next issue, because I personally did not get enough.
I'm sure we will. I'm sure, just like me, I was interested in the Joe part of the story and not so much the John Stewart part of the story. It was fine, but I'm really interested in what's going on with why the central battery's been disassembled. But it wasn't blown up, and they made it so everything stayed connected. I'm sure there's a reason behind it to be able to disable the lantern's rings and stuff and take out the Guardians. But I'm sure it's not Sinestro. I'm sure somebody else is behind it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was that radical group we saw on the first issue.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely with you, Drew. You know, the first half really isn't doing anything for me, because I like John Stewart, to be clear. It's not the fact that it's John Stewart. It's the fact that he's not being a Green Lantern. I know he's being a hero. It isn't that more important. No, honestly, it's not. It's not. I want to read a Green Lantern book to read Green Lantern. I'm sorry. That's just what I want. The problem is that's the majority of the book. Both issues we've gotten of this so far have been heavily the John Stewart story, in which he's not a Green Lantern. And then, oh, by the way, in case you like them using their rings or whatever, I guess, here's like two pages for you.
I know, that's what it felt like, didn't it?
It's like, you guys are prioritizing this completely wrong. We got to flip the ratio completely the other way. You know, I mean, and I'm not going to lie, one of the reasons I'm so interested in the Joe part of the story is because of Sinestro's involvement. I agree with you. I don't think that he's responsible. We know from Future State that he's going to attempt to fill the power vacuum, which that makes sense. I mean, that totally makes sense for Sinestro, but he's a little more, usually more wanting people to know what he's done, to put it lightly. So this seems a little underhanded for him, or a little too subtle, maybe. It might be a better way to say it. But like, I'm really interested in that, because that's the part that feels most like an actual Green Lantern story. There are rings involved. I am a huge Sinestro Corps fan to begin with. So like, that interests me a lot, because I feel like I'm getting an actual Green Lantern story. The majority of the comic is just frustrating, because it's like, I mean, all of this would be more cool if John was using his ring.
Exactly. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Justice League number 64. The United Planets put Simnar Utopica on trial. There's only one problem. The prisoner has escaped. Oliver and Dinah spend some quality time together watching the sunset. Then the couple head to Oliver Queen's villa that he's purchased from Ted Kord. There, Oliver reveals to Dinah that they are being hunted and the person has a sniper rifle. Quickly overcoming their hunter, Oliver learns it's Damon Rose from Checkmate. I'm going to stop right here for a minute because this felt like it was trying to tie into the Checkmate miniseries. Did you get that?
Yes. I agree completely. I think it was.
Was the Checkmate miniseries also written by Bendis?
Yes.
Oh, that's why. Okay. Yep. All right. That makes sense. Exactly.
I have to say, though, it didn't feel like it belonged. I didn't need that. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't anything in there remotely interesting enough for we know that Green Arrow's involved in the new Checkmate, whatever's going on with that. That's fine. This gave us nothing. It literally was just filling space in a comic.
I totally agree. At the Hall of Justice, Aquaman trains Naomi in hand-to-hand combat. Naomi's parents come for a visit, and Black Adam compliments the parents on how they've raised their daughter. The Justice League gets an urgent message from the United Planets. Hawkslayer informs them Simnar Utopica has escaped and is heading to Earth to kill Superman. It's funny, when I read the story, it seemed like there was a lot more going on. When I did the recap of the story, not much happened.
Yeah, I would agree. It was just I felt like a lot of filler. I don't know. It's fine. I mean, it's not poorly written or anything like that, but I am very interested in seeing the Justice League take on Sinmar. That's cool. I have no problem with that. It felt like he, for whatever reason, couldn't figure out a way to fill the whole issue, which is baffling. And so it just felt like a lot of just like killing time. I don't understand it, Drew. I didn't understand why it felt like we were
standing around talking.
You can't have slow character building moments and have just like dialogue focused moments. You can, but none of them felt like they served any real purpose.
No, not really. All right, we also had a Justice League Dark story. Now, last issue we saw Elnora Roshtu follow a voice into a church in Gotham, and she's looking for a prisoner who knows much about Merlin's betrayal. Elnora is fighting the rogue men of a cult when Batman steps in and helps. Batman tells Elnora that these men are the brothers of the Ambrosius. They are projecting psionic waves at various locations in Gotham. For what, Batman doesn't know, but he's been tracking their movements for weeks without leads. Batman concludes the lack of evidence now makes sense. They're using magic. In the Tower of Fate, Khalid rests exhausted by the visions his helm has shown him, and Kirk Langstrom knows it's time to reach out to his old friends. At the Hall of Justice, Roy Regan, Ragman, joins the Justice League Dark Team, and during a private conversation with Zatanna, Roy speaks of secrets and how they have a way of turning life upside down. Batman tracks down a hideout of the Brothers of the Ambrosius, and they've been waiting for Batman. They open a door that causes Batman to lose his grip on reality and his ability to move quickly to defend himself. Elnora shows up and saves him, and she seems unaffected by the magic. Elnora finds the prisoner, Radir Singh, who's hooked up to some weird machine and claims he's trapped in his own body.
I mean, consistent with our reviews of this title, this is the real lead story here. I know it comes second, but like, come on. It's so good.
I totally agree with you. And with it being a backup story, it always reads really quick. I have to agree with the same thing that I said with the Justice League story. Not too much happened in this story either. But at least this one moved the story along.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with this one, though, is that they are so short. It's hard to do a ton in a single issue. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously, I would say this wasn't necessarily the most action-packed of the stories so far for Justice League Dark, but They're also, I mean, they're not that long. I'm a lot more forgiving of there being less action in a backup story.
One thing I found interesting in this story was the fact that Rory, when he had his little private conversation with Zatanna, we got the importance on the words, we got the importance on the upside down in his conversation, hinting that he kind of knew what was going on with Zatanna. I found that pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, remember, he read the book that was sort of metafictionally revealed that she was still influenced by the Upside Down Man when they were in the library.
Oh yeah, that's, I totally forgot about that. I'm glad you brought that up. That even makes more sense now. So, do you think that's the reason he joined the team?
No. I mean, they hinted, she in their conversation addressed that. I mean, he clearly wants to help legitimately, but also, as she mentions in their conversation, his robes clearly are hungry for souls, as she says. So there seems to be a kind of a dual purpose to his being on the team, much like he's kind of hinting that you've kind of got something else going on too. So why don't we keep each other's secrets?
Yeah, that makes total sense.
One thing I think I probably should have realized last issue, but I didn't. I don't remember if they mentioned the name or if I just didn't connect the dots. I didn't realize that the knight in the story here was the one that Merlin appeared to have killed at the beginning of the story. And so it was kind of like an, oh, that's who that is moment for me this issue. Again, I feel like I probably should have known that last time, but I did not connect the dots until this issue. So that was an interesting reveal for me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say about Merlin too, I think. That's what I'm looking forward to getting from him.
Oh, let's talk about the woman that Batman is working with.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the dude who was tied up.
Well, he seemed to be related to the woman.
Oh, like a brother or something?
Yeah, brother, some sort of, yeah. But so anyway, I realized this issue, and because she addresses herself as the 13th Knight, and I was like, oh, that's who Merlin killed when he goes to retrieve the sword at the beginning of the story. And I just completely spaced that. I think I should have realized that's who she was last issue, but that was a dawning realization for me this time.
All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Girl number 2. Last issue, Yara was at Iggy Falls when she heard music and leaned over the railing. Something grabbed her and pulled her into the water, something that looked like a mermaid. Now, this issue starts off with the origin of that creature, a great warrior by the name of Iara. Her abilities and her reputation were so great they delighted her father each day. Her jealous brothers plotted to kill her and were met with her great skills. She slaughtered the two where they stood. As punishment for their deaths, the father threw the daughter over the cliff edge to the waters below. She survived the fall. A fishtail grew where her legs had once been, and she would remain protector of the sacred waters by luring evil men that dared to step close to the water's edge. Not all perished Aya's embrace. Yara, her namesake and fellow warrior, returned to restore the balance of nature of the world of man. Iara bestows upon her a gift, and the hero's journey can finally begin. We see that Yara is placed back over the railing by Iara unconscious, and the different factions of the Amazons react. We see Banna Migdol in Egypt sends out assassins. Artemis wishes to take care of this herself, and Queen Faruka gives her permission with reluctance. In Washington, D.C., at the Hall of Justice, Queen Hippolyta tells Cassie that Themyscira has already dispatched an envoy to go meet Yara. Cassie volunteers to go herself. On a plane back to her hotel, Yara and the bus driver are talking when the plane hits some turbulence and the lights go out. When the lights come back on, a woman is staring strangely at Yara. Yara picks a fight and then punches her out with one punch. Another woman tries to ram Yara with a food cart, and Yara kicks the cart and it punches a hole in the side of the plane. Cassie runs into Artemis and the two get into a fight. Two other Amazons show up and tell them both to go home before they further embarrass their kind. Elsewhere, we learn that Hera has dispatched her grandson, the god Eros, and his companion god of the West, Zephyros, on an errand to retrieve Yara. Eros accidentally cuts himself with one of his arrows, causing him to fall uncontrollably in love with the first person he sees, Yara.
What another great issue of this series. One thing that was surprising to me, Drew, and I don't know that I realized that in the first issue, it doesn't seem like Yara realizes who she is yet. Or, I don't know, it just seems like she... The first issue, I guess I was just under the impression that we were at a... Yara was an established Amazonian of some level. And it seems less the case in this issue. She didn't really seem to know what the hell was going on. That was surprising to me.
I started reading issue number 2. And decided it had been too long since I read issue 1, so I went back and read issue 1, then reread issue 2. It was pretty clear, because I was thinking the same thing. I thought she was established too, and then when I started reading issue 2, it was like, wait a minute, this is like an origin for her. I went back and read issue 1. Okay, she doesn't know who she is. She came to Brazil because she wanted to find out where she'd come from, because her aunt, I think she's living with her aunt in the States. Her aunt won't tell her about Brazil. So she's curious. So, she's a grown woman now. She's going to go there and check it out for herself. And we see that she gets pulled down by this being and granted powers. So I'm guessing she had the ability to have powers before because of her ancestry, but she wasn't granted them until this being pulled her down into the water and gave her powers. I guess she saw something in her or something. At least that's what the issue kind of hinted at. And apparently there's some prophecy about her, because all the Amazons are in an uproar about it. Some of them are trying to kill her, and some of them are just trying to... it feels like Themyscira itself. They're just sending people to bring her back so they can evaluate her. The other faction looks like they're trying to kill her. So,
very interesting. This is what I was talking about earlier with the Future Nubia title. Is the only thing I found somewhat confusing in this book was the just kind of political state, so to speak, of the Amazonians. I know that they're in different groups, but like I was just like it was a little hazy to me. I was like, I don't understand why we're so split on what's going on here. And I also didn't fully, like, Hippolyta seems like she's still the queen of Themyscira, but we've seen other people exerting more, what seems to be more authority over Amazon. So it was just like, I was a little confused on that. But everything else, I was just like, oh man, this is, the art, Joel Jones is just hands down one of the best artists right now in comics, in my opinion. And I love the fact that she keeps inserting South American mythology that I know absolutely nothing about. So, like, all of this is brand new to me. Like, it's cool. Don't get me wrong. I love when we get, like, Greek and Norse mythology stuff, because it's sort of like, oh, I recognize that, and I see the interesting twist you're putting on it. For this stuff, I'm like, I don't know anything. So this is just brand new. This is, like, brand new introduction to some mythology for me.
The Amazons aren't the only ones that are after Yara. You even got Hera after Yara. And I'm wondering, we saw in the first issue, it looked like Zeus got executed and there was an uproar on Olympus. I'm wondering, I was reading this issue today. I'm like, I wonder if this ties into the Wonder Woman story we're reading, where we see there's stuff going on Olympus. And I'm wondering if, you know, we know that Janus was behind it, but I wonder if Hera is behind him. I'm very curious about that. I'm feeling like these titles are all going to tie together, and I'm kind of excited about that.
I think, and you know, Drew, I think one of the reasons why the Wonder Woman books are working as well as they are right now, and this is just my opinion, is because the Future State stuff really didn't reveal anything, right? I mean, like, we got technically Future State Wonder Woman and Wonder Girl stories, but they weren't, like, the Wonder Girl story was honestly one of the best because it was just a self-contained story. It wasn't really about any sort of future status or anything other than Yara is Wonder Girl. That's really it, right? So I think that's one of the reasons why both this and the Wonder Woman title are working, because they're not building towards a story that we already know. They're building a story of their own that we don't know. And I think that's why they're well written. Obviously, that's the major thing, but I'm more engaged because I don't know where those stories are going.
Yeah, we have no clue where this is going, and it's exciting. They're using the mythology, and they're using, we're getting to see what's we're getting to see what's going on with all the Amazons, all the different factions of the Amazons. So it's truly telling us an encompassing tale that we don't know what's going to happen. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our DC TV.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Geek here with a shout out to all the scientists who worked tirelessly to bring a COVID-19 vaccine into reality. Let's face it, creating something of this magnitude is a miracle worthy of Dr. McCoy himself. And now, Dr. Geek needs you to do your part. Remember, each shot is one small step back to normal, one giant leap to putting the pandemic behind us. We can do this. For more information, visit vaccines.gov to find your nearest provider.
And we're back. Let's talk The Flash, Season 7, Episode 6, POW. Barry has a dream where Nora shows up and tells him that their family and the future has changed. The Godspeed clones are wreaking havoc on Central City in what the media is calling the Speedster War. Joe and Kramer are being hunted by Adam. John Diggle shows up with a weapon built by Sisko to help end the Godspeed War. It can trap an object in time. Flash and Spartan capture a Godspeed clone. Barry learns from the Godspeed clone that the original six clones want to steal Barry's speed so they can give it to their master, August Hart. When August has their speed, they will be terminated. The six new clones don't want to die, they want to live. Barry also learns that August Hart is currently in his timeline. The clones are looking for him. Diggle and Cecile team up to find August Hart. Diggle has some sort of mental attack, and Cecile states that there's more than that. It's just more than a headache. It felt cosmic. Barry tries to run to the future 2049 to check up on Nora, and he's blocked by Godspeed clones. Dion Owen shows up and tells Barry that they have a lot to talk about. Something is causing Iris to keep moving in and out of the timeline, and Dion is using his Steel Force powers to keep Iris stabilized. Spartan shoots a Godspeed clone with nanites, courtesy of Ray Palmer. The nanites are able to block the clone's speed. When Diggle has another episode, Frost saves him from getting a vibrating hand from a clone. John, Cecile, and Frost find August, but he seems to have lost his memory. Joe and Kramer are being hunted by Adam, and when they flip the tables on him, Kramer demands the truth. Adam states he's immortal, and he's becoming an assassin, giving half the money he makes back to the reservation. At the end of the episode, Nora shows up to talk to Barry, and she brings her brother Bart with her.
The dialogue in this episode, Drew, was just, it's incredible how far downhill this show has gone. I know I harp on this point honestly too much, and I don't want to. I don't want to be such a negative Nancy with this show, but like a lot of this dialogue was just awful, where they're just saying stuff to essentially just like explain to the audience. It's that trope where like characters, the exposition, where they're saying stuff for the audience's sake, not for the people in the room's sake, like them explaining who Diggle was, overly detailed. Everybody in that room knows who Diggle is. Nobody would actually do that in conversation. And I get like, and I as for like, I get the point of some of that, but it's just so frustrating. I know this show could do better. I'm not expecting Oscar-winning writing, but like, so it's got to be better than this.
One thing I had to say about this episode, Of all the shows Diggle's been showing up in, I think this was the best use of him. Of course, he was playing his own character in this.
He was Diggle in Gotham, too. Or I should say Batwoman.
Oh, was he? I don't remember. He was. But this seemed like the best use of him to me. And he was in more of the episode.
And they definitely hinted at what we assume is the Green Lantern story. But leave it to CW to find the most, like, unfulfilling, dissatisfying way to do that story.
Oh, yes, definitely.
I don't know what... I'm assuming we're going to get an actual answer or payoff or something in Superman and Lois. And, or... is he supposed to be in Supergirl? I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
And one of those two... My assumption is it's Superman and Lois. That's just a guess. I don't know. I'm already expecting to be disappointed in whatever their answer is, because not because of that show, but just because what are they doing? He's getting memory loss or headaches from, I mean, come on. It was a great way for the show to just, like, I was already not expecting to like whatever they were going to ultimately do with their, I'm assuming, Green Lantern fake out, but good Lord, Drew.
Yeah, I'm totally expecting it not to be anything Green Lantern.
It's going to be like a piece of kryptonite or something. Whatever. Okay, so getting to the big reveal at the end, we get Bart, and we were speculating whether it was going to be his kid or grandkid like he is in the comics. Not shocking that they went with kid. But don't, to me, and I'm curious how you feel, Drew, doesn't this just completely undercut any threat to the plot that we're watching? Nora just shows up fine and dandy, along with Bart, fine and dandy, completely unconcerned with whatever Godspeed crisis they're dealing with. Well, why would they be unconcerned, Drew? Because they know it's going to work out. Obviously, it's going to work out. I'm not expecting Flash to lose. It's the Flash. But still, you know what I mean? Like, well, great. Well, whatever is going to happen during this plot, clearly Iris is totally fine.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I have to agree with you, because they come in and they come there and it's like no big deal, like you said. It's like, oh, hey, hi, Dad, how's it going? We know there's Godspeeds here, but we're not worried about it.
Completely unconcerned. Made a point to show how unconcerned they were about the ongoing Godspeed thing. And it's like, again, I know what I'm watching. I know I'm watching a CW show. I know Flash is ultimately going to win whatever the conflict is. I get that. But we could at least pretend, right? Like, act like there's going to be tension to the story. Good grief.
I know. You would have expected Nora to show up and like, oh no, something major's happened in the future and, you know, everything's going to go to hell. You know what I mean? Yeah. But that's not what happened.
Also, honestly, if I'm being completely honest with you, Drew, I was a little bit disappointed when she actually showed up, too, just because I felt like the one thing I actually felt tension in regards to was whether Nora actually existed still or not. I felt like the show done a great job leaving that very much up in the air, whether she was going to still be, because the future had changed, right? And was it just going to, instead of Nora, was it going to be Bart? And that's an interesting dynamic. Like, you have this daughter that you grow to love, and then ultimately she never actually comes into existence, and you have to, as a parent, deal with the emotional ramifications of that while not allowing that to harm your relationship with the son that replaced her. That's pretty interesting, right? Like, there's some good dynamics that could be done there. And then they're like, ah, just kidding, she's back. No worries, viewer. Absolutely no worries whatsoever. Anything that we're showing you that could have tension to it, don't worry about it. It all works out.
Yeah, I agree with it. That would have been an interesting story if Bart replaced Nora. I could see that being a very interesting story.
That feels like a relatively obvious story to go with. I'm not posing these potential stories as like something that I think is clever necessarily that I've come up with. I feel like that's a natural route for the story to go. And the writers just insist every time on taking, like, what's the dumber thing we could do? We're at a fork in the road in the story. What's the dumb way we could take this story? Oh, let's go here. Okay. Every time.
You know what would have been even more interesting? Reverse Flash showing up. Saying there's something wrong with the future.
Anything other than the one thing that the show had done a good job building tension, even just recently, let alone ignoring the finale two seasons ago, we had this phenomenal tension on whether Nora was alive, existed, whether that was still going to be their daughter. Would she be the same? And then she just pops up. We are A-OK. Absolutely no problem. I mean, way to just completely undercut any emotional tension or any emotional, like, you know, plot developments. Barry shouldn't be worried about literally anything for the rest of the season, Drew. It's all going to work out. He's got to be the most carefree dude in the world for the remainder of this season.
I'm sure that's not going to happen. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 1, Out of the Deep Woods. No one knew what came first, the virus or the hybrids. Gus grew up in the woods inside a fence built by his father. He was a cross between a deer and a human, but his father loved him. When a man comes to Gus's home looking for his sister, they learn about the outside world. There's no rules, no laws, and once the internet went down, it was over. There's tribes of people scared fighting over whatever's left. The man marked their property with pink ribbons, so Gus's father hides Gus in a cubby and tells him not to come out until he comes back. And we see Gus's father has some sort of spear weapon. When Gus's father comes back, he is sick, and he has the twitching pinky, a sure sign that he has the virus. Gus's father tells him about his mother, and they were separated. Her name was Birdie. Gus goes to collect eggs for breakfast. When he returns, his father has passed. By his 10th winter, Gus is the man of the house. One day, Gus finds a map that leads him to the cash box that his papa buried. In the box, Gus finds a picture of his mother. On the picture, it's written RR Colorado, and Gus remembers seeing Colorado on a map. Gus gathers his belongings and packs them on a sled. When he's leaving to go to Colorado, Gus finds a candy bar. He picks it up and starts eating it. Soon he sees another, and he goes to grab it, and it's a trap. Hunters capture him. As Gus struggles to get away, a big man appears and chases off the other two. Gus runs back to his papa's house, but the big man follows him. At first, he's going to take Gus, but changes his mind when Gus speaks. The big man gives Gus some advice and then leaves. Gus decides to chase after him, and Gus asks the big man to take him with him.
Can we just talk real quick about the massive quality change from one show to the other?
No kidding. And
oh, my God.
And it was very interesting seeing Gus grow up. And that was basically what this first episode was about. I know the series was going to be about him going out into the world, so it was interesting to learn more about Gus and his father and his mother and their little world there and kind of what happened on the outside of the world all in this episode, kind of introducing us to Gus before he goes out on his journey. I really like that. And I got to tell you, the quality in this slapped you in the face compared to what we get in the previous show.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I'm excited for the return of some of the HBO Max stuff is just, I understand CW can only do so much, but like, good Lord. I mean, this was good. Even so, just ignoring that, moving past that, this was really good. Like I said, I was loosely familiar with the title. I certainly have not read all of Sweet Tooth, but I'm a big Jeff Lemire fan, so I've like thumbed through some stuff before. This was excellent. This was such a good first episode. And my girlfriend didn't know anything about it either. I couldn't really tell her much because I didn't know a ton either, other than that, like, there were human-animal hybrids in it. That was about all I knew. And she was hooked right away, too. I mean, this is just I highly, highly recommend this show to people. It's good stuff.
It is. And I had to force myself not to watch the second episode.
It's tough because it's so good, and you want to see where it's going to go next. I'm also just personally excited, being from Wyoming. I doubt they shot on location. I'm sure they shot somewhere that looks like it. But even something that looks remotely like Wyoming is exciting for me. So I'm excited to see them walk around that area.
That's funny. I really enjoyed this, and I'm excited about watching the second episode. I can tell you that. It's nice to get something different. And this is having a DC property that's not a superhero, and, you know, the chance to talk about it, doing something different for once. I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Like I said, and I like that I'm not super familiar with the title, because I don't really know where the show's going. So I'm just along for the ride, man. I'm going to enjoy it. It's going to be good stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
I mean, naturally, I know I've actually mentioned this before when referring to Jeff Lemire stuff, but Sweet Tooth by Jeff Lemire. If you enjoyed the Netflix show, you got to check out the comic series. It's written and drawn by him, which I think is interesting, because I think some people might think of him as just a writer. And certainly he does a lot more of that, but he's got a very unique art style, and I like it. And I think I've mentioned this before, Drew. I met him at a convention in Leeds, England. Image was the only one. So DC and Marvel weren't there, but Image made a huge point to be there. And so there were a lot of big DC and Marvel writers there that were there for their own Image titles. Like Scott Snyder was there. Jason Aaron, who does a lot of Marvel stuff, was there. And Jeff Lemire was there. So I actually got a Green Arrow comic signed by him. And it was one of those blank ones, like, you know, the white covers. And he did, like, his own sketch of Green Arrow on it. Completely, like, of his own volition. I'd have been happy with him just saying Jeff. So it was awesome. So, I mean, like I said, if you're really only familiar with his stuff as a writer, it's even more reason to check out Sweet Tooth, because you can see what the guy can do as an artist as well.
All right. And for my shout out, I'm just going to reiterate our shout out from last week, because it was by Jeff Lemire too, the deluxe edition of Green Arrow, which I'm enjoying. So lots of Jeff Lemire stuff to check out. All right. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman Urban Legends, Batman the Detective, Future State Gotham, Justice League Last Ride, The Joker, Rorschach, Action Comics Annual, The Flash Annual, Detective Comics, Wonder Woman, Infinite Frontier, and of course our DC television shows, Superman and Lois, The Flash, Legends Tomorrow, and Sweet Tooth. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman,
all the world is waiting for you, and the power you possess. In your satin tights, fighting for your rights,
and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.